I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Last month, the NCAA released a policy of sorts about eligibility for transgender athletes to compete, saying that the governing bodies for each sport would determine their own policies. This week, USA Swimming said elite athletes must have a low concentration of testosterone, 5 nanomoles per liter for 36 months, to compete. That could affect University of Pennsylvania swimmer Leah Thomas. Her transition from the men's team to the women's team, where she is beating records, has raised some questions about trans athletes, fairness in sports, inclusivity, and the right to compete. We begin our conversation today with scientist and transgender athlete Joanna Harper. Harper was assigned male at birth, raised as a boy, becoming a nationally ranked runner. She transitioned more than 15 years ago and has been studying the impact of testosterone on athletic performance. She's a visiting fellow for transgender athletic performance and a PhD student at Loughborough University in the UK. Co-author of a book called Sporting Gender, The History, Science, and Stories of Transgender and Intersex Athletes. Joanna Harper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Let me just get your reaction to this USA Swimming new policy just came out in the last 24 hours. Is this fair?
Every other governing body that has put in a testosterone policy has either used a period of 12 or 24 months. There seems to be no obvious reason to use 36 months for the USA Swimming policy, except for the fact that Leah Thomas will have 34 months of hormone therapy come the NCAA championships in March.
You're saying it's targeted against her?
Absolutely.
Why do you say that?
Well, as I say, in a 20-year history of creating such policies, no other governing body has chosen a waiting period of anything other than 12 or 24 months. There is no suggestion that any remaining advantages that exist after 24 months will be undone by a further 12 months of hormone therapy. So I can't see any other possible reason to choose 36 months.
Help us understand. I said 5 nanomoles. I hope I pronounced that correctly, per liter for 36 months. Help us understand what that means. For instance, how does that compare to cisgender women and their level of testosterone?
So cisgender women, the normal range is under 2 nanomoles per liter. But that's the normal range means the 95% confidence level. However, there is a condition that 5 to 10% of cis women have called polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS. And it can induce mild testosterone elevations up to 5 nanomoles per liter. And women with PCOS are overrepresented in sports, so it's an advantage to have this condition. But it's a small advantage. No one would try to legislate against that advantage. So if you'll let cis women with PCOS and 5 nanomoles per liter of testosterone compete in the women's division, you should do the same for trans women. And so that's why the 5 nanomoles per liter.
And does how much of a difference does testosterone make when it comes to performance?
It depends. If you're looking within the female competition or within the male competition, it doesn't necessarily correlate. But if you're looking between men and women, then the predominant factor that differentiates between male and female athletes is testosterone. The lower end of the male range is 8, and it goes up to 25. And on average, men have 10 to 15 times more testosterone. So it's a very, very important factor. And if you're going to choose a differentiating factor between male and female athletes, it's the most logical one to use.
And it seems that the puberty is really this critical time. As I understand it, when you compare the performance of boys and girls, we're talking very binary here, but boys and girls before puberty, you know, they pretty much compete on a level playing field. First of all, do I have that right?
Correct. There are some minor differences, but until puberty, the differences are minor. But then when boys hit puberty, their testosterone levels explode, and all of the things that happen that we see with pubescent boys happen to them, including a huge increase in their athletic capabilities.
So we're talking about what? Taller, stronger, faster. I'm thinking of all those criteria.
Higher hemoglobin levels as well, thicker bones. All of the sort of standard differentiators in athletic performance.
Well, let me ask you, because you transitioned, as I mentioned in the introduction, you were assigned male at birth, you were raised as a boy, you actually were a nationally ranked runner until you transitioned. When you transitioned to female, and I'm assuming, taking drugs in order to do that, what was the impact on your performance?
So within 9 months of starting hormone therapy, I was running 12% slower, and that's the difference between serious male distance runners and serious female distance runners. So as a scientist, I was intrigued. I'm a physicist by background, but I started to learn about the endocrinology and the exercise physiology, and I started to gather data. And eventually it changed my life and led me to Loughborough University in England.
Oh, and I mispronounced the name of your university. I apologize for that. But does that tell us, even based on your own experience, that it's going to be really difficult to have a level playing field if you have cisgender female athletes and transgender female athletes competing, especially in certain sports like running or like swimming?
Well, first of all, the idea of a level playing field is illusory, and we allow advantages in sports. For instance, left-handed baseball players have numerous advantages over right-handed baseball players. However, when we segregate sports into subdivisions, we do so with the purpose of having meaningful competition within that category. And so the question isn't, do trans women maintain advantages or is there a level playing field? But rather, can we have meaningful competition between cis women and trans women? Or do the trans women dominate?
Well, can we? And can we? And I think we all, hopefully we all want meaningful competition that's, fair, broadly speaking, fair to everyone. Can we have that?
The book isn't entirely written at this point. Research is certainly in the early stages, but I suggest that it is likely that after trans women undergo testosterone suppression as part of their medical transition, in most sports, we can.
Are there sports where you think we can't?
Well, there may be sports where we might need to introduce some sort of handicap or other limits or potentially some limits for safety. And those are potential. But I think that we can come up with appropriate rules in each sport that would allow trans women and cis women to compete against one another.
Are you concerned that trans women and cis women are going to see each other as, if not enemies, but as people who are fighting against each other, especially for elite sports, for really a limited number of spaces?
Well, I hope not. I think if we acknowledge that trans women belong in women's spaces, then just like any other subgroup of women, it's reasonable if trans women do take some of those spaces. It's just if trans women take a disproportionate number of those spaces that it becomes problematic.
And it seems certainly with elite sports, if you're talking about swimming or running or some of these more timed sports, the difference between first place and fifth place could be a second. So it seems that every advantage counts.
It seems that way, but there are numerous advantages and disadvantages that aren't potentially that obvious. For instance, if we look at the NCAA, they put in rules allowing trans women to compete 10 years ago in 2011. Every year, more than 200,000 women, cis women, compete in NCAA sports. So trans people make up approximately 1% of the population. So an equal representation of trans women in NCAA sports would be over 1,000. And yet the numbers are much, much smaller 10 years after. So this idea, oh, well, trans women have advantages, they will dominate sports. It doesn't seem to be the case. And again, we have 10 years of experience in the NCAA, and no trans woman has ever won a Division I NCAA championship to this point.
Oh, that's fascinating. Are there disadvantages if someone is transitioning? Are there disadvantages that come from taking some of these hormones that could make it harder to compete in a certain sport?
Certainly, not everybody adjusts to the hormonal difference well. Moreover, the drugs that are used sometimes cause negative side effects. Trans women also have larger bodies, which are being powered by reduced muscle mass and reduced aerobic capacity, and that can lead to disadvantages, much the way that a big car with a small engine could see disadvantages. But in truth, the biggest disadvantages that trans women face are sociological, and those are still huge. The discrimination that trans people face is the major reason why trans people are so underrepresented in many, many areas of life.
Well, there's no question about that. And how do you think that affects, let's say, for an elite athlete, how does that affect performance when you are discriminated against and have to deal with, you know, hate-filled tweets, for instance?
It's hard to say. Different people react differently, but it certainly casts a negative pall. And you know, the idea certainly of somebody being so visibly out as Leah is in her sport makes her a target for a lot of vitriol, and it's extremely unfortunate.
And she's has been abiding by NCAA guidelines, so she didn't ask for this.
No, you know, trans people don't transition for sports. Leah transitioned to be herself just as every other trans person does. She's an athlete. She wanted to continue in her sports. The NCAA had a set of rules that she abided by. And now in the middle of the season, the NCAA has changed their rules.
Well, we have to leave it there. And Joanne Harper, thank you so much for getting our conversation started. So much to talk about.
You're welcome.
And a visiting fellow for Transgender Athletic Performance, PhD student at, and I'm going to mispronounce it again, Loughborough University in the UK, a scientist and transgender athlete. We're going to continue this conversation with our second guest, and you can join us. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and today in Radio Times, we're getting three perspectives about the participation of transgender athletes, about fairness in sports, and inclusivity. University of Pennsylvania swimmer Leah Thomas, who swam for the men's team until recently when she transitioned, taking testosterone-suppressing drugs, now swims for the women's team where she has been breaking records. Our guest is Skylar Baylor, author, activist, life coach, and was the first trans athlete on an NCAA Division I men's team when he swam for Harvard University, wrote a book called OB Is Man Enough. He was originally recruited to swim on the women's team before he transitioned. He's been an outspoken critic against transphobia and laws that discriminate against transgender youth. And Skylar Baylor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me today, Marty.
You're very welcome. You know Leah Thomas, and I should say that she, you know, has, I think she's only done one interview. She has been dragged into this either conversation or debate or controversy, however you want to define it. Do you know how she's doing?
You know, I think that she's doing the best that she can. And every time I talk to her, her hair is wet because she's gotten out of practice. and I ask her how practice has been, and she's been able to focus on swimming, I think, which has been really great. Of course, there's tons of hate and very cruel commentary online, and I know that she's not reading it because it's not helpful to her. It's not healthy for her, and I agree with that.
Well,
so I think she's doing the best she can.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And my understanding is that her teammates have stood up for her. There have been some criticisms,
yes,
even coming from the University of Pennsylvania, from some alumni. But her team, and I think that's what matters the most, are standing with her.
Yes. Yeah. As far as I know, that's also accurate. I know she has really great support with the coaches and team and even administration at Penn.
What do you think of this USA Swimming's new policy? How do you see it? I realize you're not a scientist and a researcher like our first guest, but as a swimmer yourself, how do you see it?
Well, I think there's a pretty big lack of precedent to change the rules mid-season, right? Same with when the NCAA changed their rules mid-season. I think that is very concerning. I also think it's concerning that that the actual contents of the rules are being changed in terms of how long one needs to be on testosterone suppression, and especially beginning at the age of 13. That's also very concerning, treating 13-year-olds like adults, which they are not. So I am concerned with the rules. I do not agree that they are going to be the most inclusive that they could be, and I'm worried about what it implies, mm-hmm, regarding Leah.
What would be better rule? What would be a better rule?
There, I mean, in my opinion, we should be looking at the experts, and the experts are the most well-respected policymakers in the world on sports and elite sports would be the IOC, right? The Olympic Committee, and the IOC has very clearly in their November release valued inclusion over everything, including. Value inclusion first, and then asking to prove evidence through evidence-based research what advantages might exist and then mitigate those appropriately. And I think that we should be following that at elite levels.
Let me ask you about the non-elite levels, and I'm actually looking at the press release from USA Swimming News, and I'm just quoting here. It's a little legalistic, but nonetheless, on the non-elite level, an inclusive process has been established by which an athlete can elect to change their competition category in order for them to experience the sport of swimming in a manner that is consistent with their gender identity and expression. I don't know if you can translate that for us, Skylar, but how do you see this policy?
Yeah, I mean, the non-elite policy, as far as I understand it, is that a non-elite athlete can compete for whichever team they prefer, and if they become elite, then different rules apply. And I think this is an excellent rule, given that when we are talking about non-elite sports, it doesn't truly matter what gender you were assigned at birth. You should be allowed to participate and have fun in sports, and I know that's a core value of USA Swimming.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Skylar Baylor, author, activist, was the first trans athlete on an NCAA Division I men's team when he swam for Harvard University. As I mentioned, originally recruited to swim on the women's team before he transitioned. And again, we want to hear from our listeners. Where do you stand on this? This is tricky stuff. It's complicated. But we want to find out what you are thinking. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Skylar, you sent us a terminology guide to use in order to interview you, and I thought that was, first of all, extremely helpful. But it also, sure, I think, tells us that we are still trying to understand about gender and sex identity, about pronouns and what people call themselves. We have lived in this very binary world. And I wonder whether we're still learning the language of how to talk about this conversation. So we're going to make mistakes. I certainly have done that myself. But we're sort of seeing our way through this new world, certainly of athletics, but also of identity.
Mm.
You agree?
Yes. I mean, I think that, well, language always evolves, right? And I don't think that that's unique to this situation with regards to expansion of understanding of gender, but it is relevant here. So I always encourage people to start with terminology and start with language, because I think it's the first and best way that you can begin respecting another person. And it's very difficult to have a conversation about anything that is tense or emotional or any kind of weight, if you will, if we can't start from a place of respect. Right. So that's why I always send terminology. It's why I focus on it a lot when I give trainings, because I want to start with the most respectful language, and then we can talk about more difficult concepts.
You were born and identified as a girl, raised as a girl, transitioned to male. You were a swimmer from almost before you could walk. What was it about swimming that so appealed to you?
Well, let me do the thing that I just actually said that I would do and edit the language a little
okay,
bit.
Okay, and I realized even as I spoke, I was like, uh-oh, I think I screwed up. And then go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's okay. Let's talk about it, because this is an important moment. Yeah, so I would never say that I was, quote, born a girl, right, and then transitioned to a man. I was assigned female at birth, which means when I was born, doctors looked at me. They said, okay, this is a girl. And everybody said, okay, this is a girl. Then I grew up and I was like, wait, hold on, this is not actually me. I'm actually a boy, and I explained that to people. I transitioned. Transition involved changing parts of my body and my expression to match who I am, but I did not change who I am. And that distinction is really important. Most trans people do not consider transitioning changing who they are. I have always been me, a boy. I have always been me, male. I just haven't been able to explain that always. I haven't always had the resources or the safety or the courage to say, hey, this is who I am. So transitioning was claiming, hey, this is who I am, and then shifting things about my presentation that then match who I truly am.
And I appreciate that correction.
Sure.
And again, you know, it does get back to the importance of language, the importance of using the right words.
Absolutely. And I think it's especially important when we talk about athletes and trans athletes, because a lot of people will use the wrong language in order to perpetuate this idea that, for example, trans women are, quote, men competing in women's category, when the reality is that's not true. Trans women are women competing in the women's category. And if somebody is afraid of a man pretending to be a woman in order to compete and win in the women's category, we are afraid of men, cisgender men, not trans women. I think it's a really important distinction to make. Going back to your question, if
sure.
You'd like me to go back to the swimming question, how did I get into swimming?
Yeah.
I was thrown into the pool when I was really little.
Really?
Literally
thrown into the pool?
I went to Mommy and Me some lessons before I could walk, actually. I learned how to swim around 10 months old, right around the same time I learned how to walk. I loved it, and my parents just kept on bringing me to the pool, and I'm very grateful for that access that they provided me. I began competing on a little league sort of local summer swim team when I was 5 or 6 and loved it, and then just kept on doing it.
And swam on women's teams until you got to Harvard. And I mean, were you headed for the Olympics? It looked like you did extraordinarily well.
You know, I think that any elite athlete would like to think that they're headed for the Olympics at some point, right?
Right.
I was good. I was on a record-breaking relay at Nationals, and that was actually with Katie Ledecky.
Uh-huh.
I have been, you know, I went to Nationals, I went to a lot of big competitions, and I did fairly well, and I was recruited for Harvard as well, which is, you know, not the top 5 necessarily, but it's a pretty good swimming school. So I was doing well, yes.
And when you decided to transition, I'm curious about the, as you said, you've always been a boy, you've always been male, what it was like to have a body that people would recognize as male, other people.
Yeah, so transitioning saved my life. There's no simpler way to put it. If I hadn't transitioned, I'm not sure if I would still be here.
Really?
Before transitioning, I was experiencing a lot of difficulty with my mental health. I actually was in a residential treatment center for an eating disorder that I was experiencing at the time when I figured out that I was trans. My eating disorder very nearly took my life. I was experiencing a lot of suicidality, experiencing uh-huh. issues with self-harm and other maladaptive coping skills, if you will. So I was all but circling the drain before I figured out that I was trans. And figuring that out and transitioning absolutely saved my life. It's the reason I'm still here today.
How did you figure that out?
How did I figure that out?
Yeah.
You know, it was complicated. I think it's something I've always known in my heart and in my soul, if you will. But I think that figuring it out took me taking a pause. I was very busy before I went to treatment, and my mental health was begging me to slow down. And when I finally did, and I was with a therapist that made me feel safe, a therapist who asked me about gender because it was clear to her that this was something that I was struggling with, that was when I was finally able to recognize, part of the difficulty I'm having with my body, part of the disconnection, the inauthenticity that I'm feeling is actually the fact that I am not presenting my truest self.
You were on 60 Minutes, and I've read some things about you. And when you came out, I guess that's the right word, came out to your parents, your coaches, your grandmother, your grandparents, people were supportive. And I think it's important to know that, because we often hear about when people are ostracized as tragic and frightening as that is, it's important to know that there are families that don't do that.
Sure. Yeah. My everybody, for the most part around me, met me with a massive amount of support and love, and I'm so grateful for that. I'm also very lucky. It's very rare in many cases to have so much support, especially from, my sports administration, from the athletic department at Harvard, from the communities around me. And I will also say that there is, I think, more acceptance of us than the media will give us credit for, because those don't make stories.
Right.
They don't go and say, oh my God, look at all these people supporting everybody, right? They usually, it's a lot of trauma porn, right? people read about tragedy. And so there is more support than I think we are reporting on. Even, for example, with regards to Leah, I've had people reach out to me, hundreds of people, commenting this, but also, some other people reach out to me and saying, hey, I support Leah. Can you tell her that? Can you give her a message from me? And cause some of these are, national team members. Some of these are other Olympians. Some of these are just people in the world. And I think it's really valuable to recognize that that also exists.
And how was your swimming performance affected by the hormones you were taking and certainly the testosterone?
Yeah, it's really hard to isolate that factor, right? I didn't do a controlled randomized study on myself, nor could I, because we do need multiple people to do that. And I can tell you that I got better in college. I would say significantly better. Mm-hmm. I think some of that probably is the hormones. Some of that was a different training regimen. And a lot of that was because I was happy for the first time in my life. I think it's something to really make sure we don't miss, is that happy athletes are good athletes. We are always better at what we do when we are emotionally at peace. And I think that that's a really important factor in this.
We have a third guest who'll be joining us, and I don't want to find like a fake middle ground here. But do you have some understanding why a cisgender female athlete might feel threatened? I'll use that word, or feel as if it's gonna make it unfair, that the level playing field will be unlevel if I'm going to be competing against a transgender female athlete.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have a couple thoughts. The first thing is, do I understand the arguments? Sure. I understand what they are saying, and I understand what people have explained. I also will go back to actually something that Joanna said, which is that the concept of a level playing field, I think the word she uses is elusive, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. There is no level playing field. We are always operating under massive systems of inequity. I mean, there's a big system that people often miss here, which is white supremacy. There's a lot of lack of access to things just because people are a different skin color, right? I think 64 to 70% of black children don't know how to swim. That is a far bigger barrier to swimming than anything else. So it's really important to recognize that sports are already unfair, firstly, because of systems of inequity that exist in the country, and also because bodies are different. Biodiversity exists, and there are lots of things that different bodies have that do result in unfair, quote-unquote, unfair advantages. When I say unfair in this situation, I mean advantages that not everybody has. Right? That's how sports work. That's why some people are great. And sometimes when people are great, especially if they are cisgender, people marvel at this, right? Michael Phelps is a complete genetic abnormality. And everybody says, wow, look at him. He's made for swimming. Nobody says he's unfair, right? So I think it's really important to recognize the level playing field doesn't truly exist. And the experts at the IOC, again, have created rules that make it as level as possible, given the restrictions that, you know, that the world already has, as bodies are different and people are different, and there's all these different, you know, factors. And I think we should be listening to those experts.
Can we find, do you think there is a middle ground? I mean, a place where people I think we're largely talking about sports where you've got cisgender female athletes and transgender female athletes competing together. Can we find some kind of middle ground where everyone feels sort of accepted and also that they'll have a fair shake?
I hope so. I don't know what that looks like. I do know that it's going to demand that cis people unpack the transphobia, misogyny, and sexism that they have been steeped in. And kind of going back to your earlier question about, do I understand these arguments from these cisgender women athletes? Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, I want to expand on that and offer that people can feel whatever they'd like. Anybody's knee-jerk reaction to say, oh, this feels unfair, that is valid. Your feelings are valid because I can't tell you to feel any differently, right? If you're mad, I can't say, don't be mad. That doesn't work, right? Everybody knows that. Your feelings, your knee-jerk feelings can be valid, but they do not mean that they are facts, right? Your feelings are not always facts. Just because you feel that something is unfair doesn't mean that it is. And I think that's a really, really important distinction. And I encourage everybody when they confront this topic to sit back and really understand that everybody in this world is steeped in systems of white supremacy, of patriarchy, of misogyny, of sexism, of transphobia. And so of course we're going to have these feelings. Of course people have these reactions. But those feelings are not facts. And we should be listening to experts for the facts, and we should be valuing and remembering that trans women are women, and trans people deserve to play sports just like everybody else.
Well, Skylar Baylor, we have to leave it there. My thanks for you. Thanks to you for joining us today in Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. My pleasure.
You're welcome. And he's author, activist, life coach, the first trans athlete on an NCAA Division I men's team when he swam for Harvard University. And we have another guest waiting in the wings. Do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Today on the show, we're exploring a range of opinions about the right of trans athletes to compete, about fairness in sports, inclusivity, and what a level playing field could or should look like for transgender and cisgender female athletes. And we do want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Joining us now is Nancy Hogshead Makar. She's an attorney and CEO of Champion Women, which advocates for girls and women in sports. She swam on the U.S. national team from 1976 to 1984 and won 3 gold medals and a silver at the 1984 L.A. Olympics. She wrote recently about University of Pennsylvania transgender swimmer Leah Thomas, saying that transgender athletes should be allowed to compete in women's sports as long as they have reduced the athletic advantage that comes with puberty. Nancy Hogshead Makar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Let me just begin to get your response to what USA Swimming said in the last day or so about trans athletes. Just your overall response to their policy.
Yeah, we have a petition out that asks for USA Swimming to prioritize fairness for biological women in sport. That is why we have sex segregation in sport. Sex segregation, if you think about it in society, it's very unusual. We don't have racial segregation. We don't have religious segregation. But we do have sex segregation in sport, and it's all because of science and biology. If girls and women are going to get an equal opportunity to participate, they need their own team.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things, and I'll go back to our first guest. I know you were listening in, and I was talking with our first guest, Joanna Harper, about a testosterone and its impact on performance. And one of the things that she said is that for certain women with polycystic fibrosis, I think I have that name correct, they actually do have a higher level of testosterone. She said they are, you know, not overrepresented among female athletes, but you tend to see them there. If the argument is about testosterone, how do we reconcile all this?
Well, the testosterone gap between males and females is gigantic, and women are typically between 0.06 and 1.6. Men usually start at 7.7. Most women who have PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, are sick, and they're usually not elite athletes. So while they may get, they're usually around 3 as opposed to men's 7.7, the vast majority of the Olympians that you see are all in the normal women's range of that 0.6 and 1.6.
So are you saying that it could just never, especially we're talking about swimming here, but it just can never be a level playing field for cisgender female athletes and transgender female athletes?
Oh, no. I mean, you can, depending on the sport and depending on, you know, how long that they've been on gender-affirming hormones. Yeah, no, I mean, Champion Women, and I'm part of the Women's Sports Policy Working Group, and we've been working for years now to try to figure out how is sport going to change to make sure that transgender athletes do have opportunities in sports. At the same time, we do want to draw some boundaries around the girls and women's category, recognize why it is that we have this category. The for people who are not in sports, the difference between the number one woman swimmer in the United States, she would be ranked 532nd in the men's event. So that goes to show you what male puberty does. It is a huge divergence. So it depends on the sport. And if a sport requires explosive power in particular, if it requires a lot of strength, then those sports are going to be much, much harder to roll back a male puberty advantage than some other sports. Joanna Harper is a good example of, she's a runner, and sports that use VO2 max, that use a lot of oxygen, that gets rolled back pretty quickly. But other things like, you know, the throws, weightlifting, certainly punching, those kinds of sports, it might not be possible.
Let me read from a letter that you and some others wrote to the University of Pennsylvania and to the Ivy League. And you wrote, "We fully support Leah Thomas in her decision to affirm her gender identity and to transition from man to a woman. Leah has every right to live her life authentically. However, we also recognize that when it comes to sports competition, the biology of sex is a separate issue from someone's gender identity." And you go on from there. Are you concerned that then the University of Pennsylvania will either fight back against this USA Swimming policy, or what are you concerned that they might do?
Yeah, the swimmers at Penn have been characterized as being supportive of Leah competing against them, and that's just not true. I wrote this letter, and the reason why you haven't heard from a lot of them is because they have been told that they'll never get a job if they do speak out. So they empowered me to send this letter that they wrote that was on their behalf. We're concerned that Penn will use its political influence, that the Ivy League, and Robin Harris is the commissioner at Penn, to do a lot of things to try to get Leah to be able to compete against them, when we have shown that Leah has not rolled back what she gained in male puberty, right? So the difference between men's and women in swimming, it's a little bit more in the sprints, it's a little bit less in the distance events, but roughly it's about 11% difference between men and women, right? And that's what Joanna Harper was saying, that she as a runner was 12% slower. So Leah is in her 200 freestyle has only she's only 2.6% slower than she was when she competed as a male. So she's on gender affirming hormones, but she is still able to take advantage of that male puberty advantage. So because she has not mitigated, those rules that were passed 10 years ago were based on a hypothesis that a year of gender affirming hormones would roll back somebody's male puberty advantage. And since then, there's been a lot of research showing that that's not true. And so we asked the NCAA to update their policies based on what the new science was. They deferred over to United States Swimming, and Swimming has come out with these policies that really prioritize fairness in the women's category in the same way that, I mean, both of the guests that you've had on, Skylar and Joanna Harper, have both talked about, there's no such thing as fairness and whatnot. But, you know, we do create sports categories specifically to try to get fairness as between competitors. We, for example, we have weight categories. And for whatever reason, we don't allow 160-pound athletes to compete against 120-pound athletes. My husband, when he was in middle school, weighed too much to be able to play football. So it wasn't safe for the other players for him to be able to participate. So what USA Swimming did is they centered all of their decision making is based on fairness for biological women in sport.
And we should say for Leah Thomas is that she has been abiding, you know, until yesterday, yes, or the day before, she has been abiding by the rules and the policies. So I don't, you know, I worry that she's being dragged into this thing that is in a sense not of her making. Let me just read a comment from Pam who says to you, stop saying biological women. The correct language is cisgendered women. If you are an expert in this area, you're aware of that, intentionally using incorrect descriptors. Can you speak to that? That's from Pam in our audience.
Yeah, I would say that for the vast majority of life, that it doesn't matter the biology of gender, of sex. And so for when it comes to employment or housing or banking or marriage or adoption, or the biology is not important. But when it comes to a very few different areas, that sport is one of the areas that biology makes an enormous difference. So we while some people might want to ignore or, you know, play down the importance of that biology, that is why we have this weird place of sex segregation. The only place that we don't sex segregate in sports are sports where male testosterone doesn't make a difference. So something like equestrian or sailing or motorsports. Well, we do sex segregate in archery.
Oh, we do.
It is a strength thing of being able to pull back. But my point is, right, sport already figured it out long before we had done all this research on what it means to be a transgender athlete. That they already made those sports that where male puberty is not important, we already made them co-ed. So only in this context, in the context of sport, do we talk about biological women. I was told by some trans advocates, and Joanna Harper is part of our group, right? So she's part of the Women's Sports Policy Working Group. And so we talk to a lot of trans advocates and ask, you know, what is the proper terminology? And they say it is okay that using biological woman is appropriate. What some people do is they use they would refer to a transgender woman who's competing, sort of, and you can kind of hear it in their voice. I'll say like biological man.
Indeed.
As a way to insult. And right, we don't want that.
No, we definitely don't want that. Let me pick up on something. And I, you know, rolling back the clock to Title IX, when, you know, we were able to say to protect and give agency to female athletes. And we created this binary world. We got male sports and female sports, male athletes and female athletes. But I think today in 2021, we know so much more about gender and identity and intersex and transgender. What that is about, that maybe this sort of binary way of looking at sex identification is limiting. What do you think about that, Nancy?
Yeah.
I mean, I realize that's a big one, but it's just we live in a binary, as much of a binary world as we used to.
Well, here's the deal. Let's say that you wanted to categorize sport on something besides sex. Okay. So you want to do it on wingspan or weight or height or, you know, some other category. That there is no other way to do it that would give women an equal opportunity to participate in sports. If girls and women are going to have those equal opportunities, they need their own team. I'm a civil rights lawyer, and we worked really hard to make sure that the law did allow for sex segregation in sport, right? That the school wouldn't just say, hey, we've got one team and let's just see who makes it. That instead we have a men's basketball team and a women's basketball team, because that's what it takes to give women equality when it comes to sport.
And I guess the question is, can there be equality for that trans athlete? If it's a trans female athlete, it wouldn't be fair for them to play on the men's team, would it?
Yeah, I mean, what Women's Sports Policy Working Group says is, look, sport needs to adapt. We right. need to figure out ways of being able to include. Joanna Harper talked about some of those ways. I mean, when Skylar Baylor went on male puberty-affirming hormones, when he went on testosterone to affirm his gender identity, he moved from the women's category to the men's category. Why? Because it wasn't fair for him to be on testosterone and compete in the women's category, right? So we're asking for essentially the same thing. But one of the things Joanna Harper talked about was, look, you can have offsets. You can have handicaps the way that we do in golf. You can have, most swimming pools are 10 lanes and eight of them compete. You could have, if there's only one or two, you could have lane nine, and that person would be on a different podium. They would be able to break different records. But, you know, right now at the NCAA, we've got Missy Franklin and Katie Ledecky's NCAA records are on the line. And, we're arguing for fairness. And then sport just needs to figure out how it's going to change. And I will say that it annoys me to no end that there is no advocacy on behalf of trans men who take boatloads of testosterone are never competitive with cis men. So I competed during the East German era. I competed against East German women. It was very unfair. None of the adults in the room essentially stood up for us. We just had to compete against them, even though everybody knew it was unfair. And so we're asking sport leaders to affirm women who are not taking, who are not on testosterone, to affirm the women's category. The East German women, no matter how many drugs they took, they were just a little bit better than we were. They were not ever competitive with the men.
Nancy, I wish we could go on. We have to leave it there. And I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Nancy Hogshead Makar. She's an attorney, CEO of Champion Women, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. The show is produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.